So we're doing part two of the study this week, and I've got a couple of other things I'm going to pass out when the time goes. I'm sort of using this book as a model, and if you look at the last page of the handout, you'll see the name and the title and all that. It's called Church History in Plain Language, and if any of you are interested in looking at it, you're welcome to do that. Nice book for a lot of reasons, but in fact, I mentioned last week, but I want to just do a little bit of a recap of where we ended last week, because that's important as we start. Is that better? Okay. So 70 AD is where we ended the first session. And 70 AD is kind of a big time because the church in Rome, the synagogue has been burned. All the stuff has been scattered. The Jews have been kicked out of Rome by the emperor. And a lot of things happened. We talked about them last week. The movement had been called a movement. It had been called the Way, and the Way was the name because of, you know, Jesus said he is the Way, the Truth, and the Life. And so it was called the Way early, and then once 70 AD happened, the Jews basically kicked the Christians out of the synagogues because they thought they were traitors for not helping to defend Jerusalem when the Romans were sacking. And so they had to get on their own. And so they went back to an old term in Hebrew called ecclesia or ecclesia, and which means the called out ones. And it's the term that means the assembly of God's people. And so it's spelled a little different in Greek and in Hebrew and whatever. But translated into English, it's called the church. And so around 70 AD, this movement began to call itself a church. And so we began to see a little bit of standardization there. The term Christian was derogatory. It was used as a slur, but the Christians adopted it and made it the way they made it a badge of honor to be called a Christian. And they were just continuing their term because the Romans, even though they had sacked Jerusalem, didn't like the Jews, and they thought the Christians were part of the Jews. They didn't like them either. And so the whole time was fraught with all kinds of persecutions and so forth. We talked about all the apostles now, except for the Apostle John, are dead, and all the books are written with the exception of Revelation. So most of the text that we call the canon of the New Testament is there and it's around. The basic structure of the church was set. I don't know if you can see over here. Let me stand over here. Okay. So the basic structure of the church was set, but it was a universal church. It was a church. They were all kind of the same. They were a little different because they were in different situations and different people, but it was a single church structure. And some of the ways they operated was pretty standard. They had a pretty standard order of service. They had somebody to read from a scroll. They'd read some of the Old Testament. They'd slant it towards prophecy. They would sing a few hymns. The elder or the pastor or the bishop or the leader would get up and say a few words. And at the end, they would ask people if they wanted to accept Christ. And that was sort of the services they had. Ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper were practiced universally. They were the two things that were practiced. We talked a little bit about names. And you can see the Greek names. All of these are names for the leader of the church. There's episkopos, presbyteros, and poimano, which are overseer, elder, and pastor, shepherd. Those are the three names that were used for the leader of the church. Today, those have different meanings for us. If you think of a bishop, you think of a different role in the church than an elder or a pastor. So they've migrated over time to more functional roles, but in the beginning, they were really the same office. They were just, depending on the way the church was set up, they were called a different thing. And of course, they also had deacons, and all of those were ordained in the flock. So they were part of the ordained ministry. And so we talked about the age of Jesus and the apostles. Now we're going to pick up at the age of the universal church. And I mentioned last week, I've used the term universal here because I want to keep your minds clear. But the Latin term for universal is Catholic. So if you read most of the commentaries like this one, it talks about the Catholic Church, the age of the Catholic Church. But it's a small c Catholic because it means universal, doesn't mean Roman Catholic. So rather than be confusing, I try to leave it as universal, because that's really what we're going to talk about. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And you can see some of the other topics we're going to talk about. One little change, that was 1925 last week. It's really 1914. Thanks to Michael for correcting that for me. And then also, I have a cartoon in last week's, if you see it, of a cartoon of the church history. I said that was Lucy because that's what all the commentaries said, but looking at it, it's really not Lucy. It's really Sally Brown, Charlie's little sister. So I made that correction on the text. But if you have last week's printed out, it'll say Lucy Van Pelt. It really should be Sally Brown. So anyway, yeah, two minor corrections, but you have to be paying
attention.
Scribal
era.
Yeah, exactly. So in this area of the church where you have bishops and elders and overseers and pastor teachers, you begin to see the roots of the structures of the modern church that we see today. Because you see those offices in different churches. Some have all of them, some have a few of them, some don't have this and have that. And you see that kind of spread out because of the way the church was formed. But all of these churches begin to, under persecution, begin to try to systematize their faith. And they did that because they wanted to look at some of the scriptures that were out there. They wanted to try to put together a Bible. And this is kind of what we're going to talk about. That's Origen. I don't have a picture of him anywhere except there. And that's just, of course, made up. But we're going to go through 312 is the end of the time today. And that's an important time because that's when Emperor Constantine becomes a Roman emperor. So the time from 70 to 312 is kind of a uniform time within this period. And six topics we're going to talk about today. First one is only worthless people need apply. Talking to the church. I want to talk about persecution. I want to talk about disputes over the event. The event meaning the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. The rise of orthodoxy that we begin to see in the church. The formation of the Bible and how that began to happen in this time. And then some discussion about the church. What is it? Is it a school for sinners or a society for saints? And those were the two kind of left and right hand discussions at this point. And I'll tell you how they came out. And we end this section about the apostles, called the apostles to intellectuals. And this is where the church begins to reach out to the more learned people in society. Some pluses and minuses for sure on that. Only worthless people. Let me talk about that for a minute. Picture the early church. The apostles, except for John, are dead. John is either in exile or he's up in Ephesus for most of his time. He's not in the general church population. He's extremely revered by all the church leaders, but he's just not there. He's up there doing his thing. And a leadership crisis develops. And so you've got second and third generation Christians now that are trying to lead the church. And so there was a leadership crisis. And so the church began to standardize on offices in the church. And so by about 150 AD, all of the churches typically had bishops, elders, or pastors, and deacons. They had put them in a structure because they had to do some things to make the church better. Another thing began to happen. You remember, the early church was made up mostly of converted Jews. So they came into the church with a very steeped background in theology, in the ways of God, and reverence for the Bible, all the things that Jews have as part of their worship tradition. As the church began to spread out and get kicked out of Jerusalem and begin to be in all these people, all these lands, all of the people coming to the church and joining the church were mostly pagans and Gentiles. There wasn't too many of the Jews coming any longer because of the animosity built up. And you know, if you read your history, the animosity between Christians and Jews really didn't become even addressed by the church until probably 1900 or so. You know, there was all this hate about the Jews and killing Jesus and all that, and the Jews hated the Christians, and it was just kind of a big problem. And you've seen a little bit of movement back, especially with Christians moving back to tell the Jews they're the rootstock from which we came, and you know, we love them and we read the Bible and we understand that to protect them and protect Israel protects us, and we think that's important. Most of the teachers and pastors themselves were weak in the faith. Most of them were not. They weren't the apostles. If you had a Timothy, or you had a Barnabas, or you had a John Mark, you were lucky because there weren't a lot of those guys around. And they were spread out. So most of the people who were teaching fairly weak stuff. And I've got a thing I'm going to pass around. It's called the Didache, or Didache, however you want to pronounce that. And it is a first century handbook of Christianity that was written as sort of a teaching manual for the apostles. And it's out on the web. You can just go find it, pull it down. The Greek is, I don't have the Greek. The English translation is pretty poor. And if I paid $10, I'd get a good translation, but I didn't do that. So you'll have to suffer with bad translation. But you see, it gives us a lot of information about how the church was structured and what they thought was important and what people had to learn and repeat as part of the creed to become a Christian. And Jewish converts just began to be smaller and smaller percentage of the church. This caused both a crisis of belief and faith. Belief and faith are the cornerstones of the church as they came out of the first century, because belief, they didn't believe because they heard it. They believed it because they lived it and they saw it. And the era of the witnesses of Jesus Christ is beginning to be over. Even the people who saw him when he came back resurrected, you know, we're 70 years later now. And those that were alive then are either dead or they're fairly old. So we're beginning to see a crisis in belief. And faith begins to change immediately. And so the church begins to institute some changes. And I guess I would put this down as I made a note on my book as I went through it. A warning for the church today is we should never focus on growth at the expense of belief and faith. Because when you get so big that you don't know what you believe, and you can't make a testament to your faith, then you have to ask yourself, are you a Christian because it's a fun place to come and visit and socialize, or are you Christian because of your beliefs? And the church got into this trouble very early in its cycle. And you can imagine, you know, growing from basically 15 people to 5,000 in the first 2 years of the church, and then being spread around, blown up essentially all around the Mediterranean, you can see that if each of the churches doubled or tripled in size, you may have had 100, 200, 300,000 members. Most of them were not Jews, didn't come with the Jewish faith and tradition. So it's sort of a trouble, and Jews saw it. Now, Roman persecution continued. Let me get sort of caught up here in my notes, because I never follow what I'm written down here. I want to make one point on the worthless people. The comment of the intellectuals of the day were they weren't worried about the church, because the church only took worthless people in. The higher-ups in the Roman authority didn't join. The real intellectuals in Greece and so forth didn't join the church, so they weren't worried about it because it was only the rabble in the lower class. And one thing I'll tell you, I don't know whether I've got it on this page or not, but one of the things the church did during this persecution time is the Romans, like a lot of ancient civilizations, if you weren't one of them, they had no use for you. And if you were killed or you were executed, they just opened the gates of the city and threw you in a pile. And the birds and the dogs and everything else came to get people. Well, Christians had this funny little idea that we're made in the image of God. And so what they would do is they'd go drag them off the pile and they'd take them and give them burial. And they were respected for that, but that's when the churches first started putting graveyards around churches, because they didn't own property because they didn't have money. When they got somebody to join that had money, they'd buy property, and they'd build a church graveyard, and they'd begin to bury people in the church graveyards. And that's sort of the tradition of that, which is kind of an interesting tradition. We get away from that in the modern churches today here, because we don't have any problem, you know, going to buy a cemetery plot or anything else. We can buy that, and there may be a day when that's not the case. But today, that's the case. So generally, in the Roman Empire, persecutions happened regularly. But the Jews were somewhat exempt, because the Romans had a tolerance policy. And as long as you didn't cause them too much trouble, they were going to leave you alone. It wasn't a problem with the Jews, because the Jews are generally a closed society. They don't proselyte. When's the last time in your house you had a Jew knock on the door and invite you to come to the synagogue? It doesn't happen. You have to go through a set of routines. You have to go through this whole training period to become a Jew, and it's an effort to do that, and you've got to want to do that to do it. They don't proselyze at all. They're a closed religion. The pesky Christians, though, are not that way. The pesky Christians, every time they get a chance, they talk about Jesus. Every time they get a chance, they talk about the resurrection. Every time they get a chance, they talk about salvation. And they're converting large numbers of people to believers. And the other thing they did is they held themselves out from the Roman society. They didn't believe in the Roman gods. Therefore, the Romans looked upon them as suspicious because they didn't understand who they were. They even called them atheists because they didn't believe in the Roman gods, which is kind of interesting when you read that in history books. But they also kept themselves apart from the normal activities. So remember the normal activities in Rome. You had the gladiator events. You had all of the throwing the Christians to the lions, big sporting events. You had the bathhouses where you had immorality ran rampant in those areas. And the Christians wouldn't participate in that. They didn't go to those. They wouldn't participate in them. And again, that aroused suspicion. You know how when we are, when somebody moves into our neighborhood that doesn't socialize, doesn't talk to anybody, doesn't do anything anybody else does, we sort of are a little curious about it. And that's the way they were, except it turned more from curiosity to something different. And the growing numbers made them very worrisome to the Romans. And they didn't like the equality of the Christian faith. You could be a slave in the Christian faith and be a leader in the church. In fact, one slave named Callistus became the bishop of Rome, and that was unheard of because a slave had no standing. And for the church to give him standing as a bishop of Rome, the Romans hated every second of that because they coveted their structure and they coveted their importance. And so they did not like the equality at all. And then because Nero had blamed in AD 64 the Christians for the fire in Rome, many emperors continued to blame all the Christians for anything that happened. One of the quotes was, "If the Tiber River floods, the Christians are at fault." You know, so and that's pretty much a scapegoating method that they had, and they used that to kind of control them. Question:
the Romans back then, is it the same as Rome today?
City's the same. The people are different. People today are Italians, not Romans. The Romans typically are the people in Romania. And there are some Romans left, but the Italians are not Romans in the sense of these Romans. If you ever talk to somebody from Romania, they will tell you they are the ancestor of the Romans, and because that's where they are. And so the heritage of the Romans, although that's really a misnomer because the Romans were a lot of different things. But anyway, it's not a normal Italian. It's not the same as a Roman, if that's what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And of course, the Christians had these two things they did. They had these agape love feasts where people would get together and they'd eat and they'd hug each other and they'd share and they'd laugh. And of course, the Romans thought they were just having the biggest time in the world. And so they looked at them because they wouldn't come to their sex orgies, but they were having their own, so to speak. And then, of course, the Lord's Supper, when you speak of the body and the blood of the Lord, and and even today, if you listen to some of the songs, being washed in the blood, being dipped in the blood. We understand those as Christians, but the Romans didn't, and they looked at us as cannibalists, just horrible people, these behind secret doors doing these things, dipping people in blood, and, all this kind of stuff. And so a lot of this came out of fear and unknown happening. And so they were persecuted. In 249 and 251, Emperor Decius, I believe is the way you pronounce that, because of the decline of the Roman Empire, because it was beginning to suffer seriously across the Atlantic, people were coming in to attack him, he decided to bring the empire together by declaring Caesar worship. So everybody, every year, had to declare Caesar as Lord. And that created a huge problem for the church, because they had to stand up and they had to declare that Caesar was Lord. For many Christians, they wouldn't do that, and they suffered death or imprisonment or exile. But a lot of them agreed to that. They said it once a year, and then they went about their business. But they said it once a year. The ones who died or stood up for their faith were called confessors. The ones who didn't were called apostates. Apostate is a word that means falling away or falling back from. So they were the ones who confessed their faith were the firm ones. The ones that fell away were called apostates. And why that's important is because we see as we get further down the pike, these apostates become larger and larger in number, and they want to come back to the church, and there's a problem in dealing with that. So the other thing that you see going on at this time is disputes over the event, let's say. And you can understand the further away you get from the event of crucifixion, the more difficult it is to be able to tell about it. And you know, if you're an eyewitness to something today, it's if you saw it, it's in your mind, it's burned into your memory, you can, with power and passion, you can talk about what you saw. But three generations from now, somebody describing that event, they won't have the power, they won't have the passion, and even over time, they'll begin to question a little bit about, was Jesus really who he said he was? And I don't want to just say, and if you know the children's little game where you whisper something to a kid that goes around the circle, and when it comes back to the presenter, it's nothing like what started. Especially, I mean, if you said cat, that would probably make it around. But if you said something that had a word they didn't know, first of all, the human mind tries to invent what it is. And so when they tell somebody, they will, in their mind, they'll bridge the gap between known facts and unknown facts. And now the person will tell it as a fact. And it'll just go from there on. And when you get back, it doesn't resemble at all what you started with. And so that's really a problem we had in the church. And because there was no Bibles to look at, there was no systemized way, they didn't have video, there was no newspapers with pictures of it, there was no MP3 files recording the events, there was nothing like we have today for eyewitnesses. It was all word of mouth and some things written down at a later time. And they were a little bit different, as you know, when you read your Bible. So it became much simpler to focus on what Jesus said and his behavior as opposed to who he was. And I'll give you a quote from Gandhi. Gandhi is one of the revered Hindu guys. And he said, I don't ever really need to find the historical Jesus. Because even if I never find him, the Sermon on the Mount is still true to me. And you think, wow, that's pretty good. But what he's saying is, I'm more interested in the behavior of Jesus than who he was. I'm not interested in whether he was God or whether he was, you know, our Savior. He had good things to say. He was a prophet that spoke good things, and so therefore I'll look at him. So it became easier to focus on Christian behavior as opposed to Christian beliefs, because telling who Christ was and what he did was very dogmatic. And you could talk about behavior and get a lot of agreement within the fellowships. And that's what began to happen. So they began to separate what he said from who he was. And that even goes on today. I mean, we see in churches today, and I won't, you know, name them, but some of them are the feel-good gospels. And you can turn them on any time, and you get hope, you get encouragement, you get love. What you never get is who Jesus was, why he died, that we have a choice to make, and that choice is a heaven or hell choice for us, because that sort of disturbs the flock.
That's right.
And so they don't do that. And so they focus today on what he said rather than who he is. And we see that today. And it's easy to fall into that, it's easy to listen to that, because it's as a Christian, you want to be uplifted, you want to listen to that. But as a believer, we need to hear all of the facts of the story and why it's important to us. Now, the church responded to that with a move towards theology and orthodoxy. Theology comes from two Greek words, theos and logos. Theos meaning God, and logos meaning the mind of God. So theology really is the study of the mind of God, or the study of the things of God, or probably a better theological term than that, but that's kind of what it means. Orthodoxy just means correct thinking or correct theology. And normally it means what the group thinks. So if 100 of us are in the room and 99 of us think something, that what the 99 of us thinks becomes the orthodox thought of the group. So the one may be right or wrong, but he's not in the orthodox group. So the church begins to push two things, theology and orthodoxy. And I want to just tell you that religion is not the same as theology.
Right.
Theology is the study of the mind of God. Religion is the way we express that belief and the way we live it out in front of our peers. So religion is the form that we use to express our belief. So whether you're a Baptist or a Methodist or a whatever you are, that religion is the way you express the belief. It's not your belief in and of itself. Those are two different things. I think we confuse them in today's world more than we should. The theology they did was they began to reaffirm the apostles' teachings. And I've put these in your notes so you can read. Of course, we know the Great Commission. John says you have to believe. To be saved, you have to believe. 1 Corinthians is Paul writing that, you know, Jesus died, was buried, and was resurrected. Ephesians talks about the unity of the Spirit, the unity of the body, and it talks about God being unified when he comes to us. And then 1 Timothy is really a sample creed. So if you look, you know, you wonder about creeds. 1 Timothy 3:18 says, "Beyond all question, the mystery of godliness is great. He appeared in a body, was vindicated by the Spirit, was seen by angels, preached among the nations, believed on in the world, and taken up in glory." This was probably one of the first little creeds that was recited. And there's two or three of them, by the way, in the New Testament. I've only listed this one, but there's two or three of them. And so they begin to reaffirm the apostolic teachings, and then they begin to say, we've got to get the scripture thing pulled together. And so they begin to pull together this canon for the New Testament. And the reason for that was both for instructions and because they had weak fellowships to get some consistency in the fellowship and get some, sermons that could be preached and be backed up with, with the word. Now, we know that the canon didn't really come to pass until about a little after 400 AD, so they worked on it quite a bit. The first thing they did was they created something called a rule of faith. And this is the predecessor of the Apostles' Creed. And if you look in this, you'll see it's like the Apostles' Creed. I've got the Apostles' Creed also written in your notes, so you'll see what they are. But it says, do you believe in God the Father, the ruler of all things? Do you believe in Christ Jesus, God's Son, born by the Holy Spirit, the Virgin Mary, was crucified under Pontius Pilate, died, was buried, rose again on the third day, alive from the dead, ascended into heaven, sat at the Father's right hand, will come again to judge the living and the dead? Do you believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Church, and the resurrection of the flesh? Probably you say actually Holy Catholic Church, Universal Church. This is what the book said was the first creed, so I don't know what it was, but any other way it is. So you can see here the essence of our faith beginning to happen. Now, if you look at the Apostles' Creed, you'll see that they added a few more things over time as it happened. But what I would say is, the whole idea of the theology of the church was put together plank by plank, heresy by heresy. As they addressed every heresy, they would come back and modify the things of the church so that people would understand that we believe that Jesus was God, that we believe Jesus came in the flesh, that he was a real person, he was God and man. Whether we understand that or not, that's what we believe. That he died, that he was resurrected, that he came back and appeared. You know, he delivered the Holy Spirit. You know, he said he was our Savior, and he lived up to his word. So those are things that we believe, but that wasn't always the case in the early church. The Bible began to be pulled together. The word Bible comes from a word, either a Greek word, biblia, or I think there's another word called biblios. And I think that may be another, I don't know if that's another Greek word or not, but it means books. Biblia means books. And the early church decided to make it Bible, to make it the book, like the book of books, you know, it's the book. And so they began to turn it into the Bible. But by the second century, most of the books of the New Testament were in circulation, but a lot of books that we don't recognize as canon were also in the in circulation at the time. This little pamphlet I passed around called the Didache, if you have got that, who's got that now? Okay. If you look at that, it's kind of cumbersome, but it does lay out kind of an early text for believers. It talks about baptism. It talks about the Lord's Supper. It's sort of a little manual about how they ran their churches. It's a piece together of apostolic stuff. That's not the best translation, but you can read through it, kind of figure out what it says. Many of the books that they looked at were not divinely inspired. And I don't have the list of them with me, but if you look at the very early books, they had books almost without exception. The Gospels, the Book of Acts, the letters of Paul were accepted. Revelation was not written until AD 95 or so, but it was not accepted early. The Book of James was not accepted early. The Book of Hebrews was not accepted early. Titus, Jude, there's a couple of others that weren't accepted early. But they were useful in the church. There was also a book called The Shepherd of Hermas. And that book was designed to be used in private, but not in public. Now, I don't know why that is. I have never read it. But I'm sure that you wouldn't want to expose it to public because it's probably got things in there that, you know, you don't want to talk about. I don't know. But anyway, it was determined to be not canonical. In other words, not authored by God and not part of the right set of books that we have. And all of these bishops began to separate the books that they liked and they used in their areas. The other thing that happened here, and I'll just say it now while it's on my mind, is the bishops began to be territorial. So you'd have a bishop in a city, like you'd have a bishop in Alexandria, you'd have one in Antioch, you'd have one in Rome, you'd have one in Ephesus, you'd have one in Jerusalem, and a bunch of the cities had a bishop. And each of those bishops had a territory they sort of managed, you know, that was some smaller churches. And they would have the books they wanted in their group. And so they held on to them, and it was very hard to pry some of those books out of common use and come up with a canon, and that's why it took a couple of hundred years to do that. And so the Bible in the early church really was non-existent. You had the Old Testament, the prophecies, you had the letters of Paul, you had the gospel letters that were being circulated, but they didn't have them bound up as a Bible. They just carried them and they referred to them as the apostolic teachings. And so the Bible was just now starting its root. Along the same time, all this persecution is taking place, and I'll just give you a number here. Let's just make up the fact that there were a million Christians in the world. And during this persecution by Rome, let's say 400,000 of them said, "Caesar is Lord," because they wanted to live till tomorrow and the next day. In the early church, they would not forgive them. That was an unforgivable sin. Unforgivable sin to turn your back on the Lord. And so they wouldn't forgive them, yet the people were out there and growing larger and larger numbers. And as you would expect in the church at that time, you had people that followed Paul, and Paul was their guiding light. You had people that followed more like James did, followed the old Jewish rules and some of the hierarchy and structure. Those that followed Paul were into grace and forgiveness. And so they had a big battle about forgiveness. And could they bring somebody back? And could they not bring somebody back? And let them into the church. And finally, remember you talking about Callistus in Rome, who was the slave? He said, "I'm going to forgive them and allow them to come back into the church." And of course, then others began to follow suit. Tertullian was another big kingpin in the early church, and he hated it because he thought it was a sin to forgive apostates, adulterers, murderers, and homosexuals. Those were the four sins that they categorized as unforgivable.
He was the first Baptist.
I'm not saying that. So dancing is not in there. So anyway, so Tertullian, and they had a big argument, but Callistus finally won that argument. And the church began to permit people to come back in. The problem we have is, what about punishment? The church's big punishment was to excommunicate people. You know, throw them out of the church. They were talked to. So they were hated by the Romans, and then they were hated by the church. So it was a real difficult position for them. And what happened was, let me just not put that up here. What happened was, the church decided that they couldn't police that from a central authority because they had no central authority. So the church decided to give bishops the right to forgive sins and set the criteria for how they could come back into the church. So what happened was, you begin to see the bishops forgiving sins and categorizing sins. You know, this is a big sin, this is a medium sin, this is a small sin. For a big sin, you have to pay me so much money. You have to give it to the church. You have to do all this kind of stuff. For a medium sin, you have to do this. For a small sin, you have to do that. So the whole idea of penance and what did the church call it back then? We paid money to...
Indulgences.
Indulgences, the sale of indulgences, yeah. So the church would say, forgive me, but I'm going to divorce my wife and marry somebody else, and it will only cost me $20,000 to pay to the church, and they'll forgive me, and everything will be back to normal. So that's sort of what happened. And three things happened in the church because of that, and we see them today. There's really three things you can say about that. We all know, if you study history, that became terrible in the Middle Ages. The whole idea of indulgences and excommunication and the power of the church reached a very terrible position. And all of it because you get on a slippery slope, and sometimes you can't stop it. You just keep going. So three positions. One of them was people in the church took the position that that was a willful and sinful departure from the apostolic path. And you see that in the churches today. You see that theory about how churches are governed. They do not like that. They don't believe that bishops have the power to forgive sin. They don't believe any of that. They won't have any of it. And they were still in the church at this time. Then you have others who say, the church was just trying to adapt to the times. They had to do something. It may have not been perfect, but you know, they had to do something. We recognize it. And it's a fluid model. We'll adapt the church structure to whatever we want to do. And then you had the third one, which is that this power was guided by the Holy Spirit, and because we, the church, decided it must be preordained that it be that way, and therefore it was binding then, it's binding now. And you generally have the three. This has turned out to be what we would call the congregational denominations today. And that includes Baptists, it includes the Brethren. There's probably a lot of congregational type churches that are out there. They don't like hierarchies. They don't like authority in hierarchies. They don't think it was the apostolic model. Then you have the other structures, which don't go to this level, but they do like the structure. They do like the hierarchy. And we see that primarily in the structured, what you call the high church faiths, which is, you know, Episcopal or Anglican or Lutheran or even Methodist, Methodism to some degree, although Methodism is probably about a 1.5 as opposed to a 2. And you can say probably Episcopals are a 2.5 as opposed to a 3. So along this gradient is sort of where the churches fall out today. But we begin to see cracks in this universal church start in about 250 AD. And so we begin to see those. And even though there's still a single church, these things don't get a lot better. And then to add to that, we have this movement. You got the church. Remember, the church is made up of a lot of people who are not real deep in the faith. They're trying to get orthodox. They're trying to teach faith. They're trying to figure out how to do that. But in the church, there happened to be some very scholarly people. And you can go back and look at Clement, Origen. Those are two early church fathers. They happened to be in the Alexandrian University or Alexandria School, and not Alexandria, Virginia, but Alexandria, Egypt. And that was one of the big centers of theological thought. And they thought, we have to get away from appealing to the farmers. We have to appeal to the intellectuals, because more and more people are going to these universities, they're getting smarter, they're getting educated. So what they decided to do was to go after the scholarly people. And so they began to move into these universities and teach something called, we call it today, Christian apologetics or Christian philosophy, or however you want to do it. And so they sort of, when you would talk about Greek philosophy or Roman philosophy or Homer or any of those guys, then they would have talk about Jesus as one of those philosophies that people can get in. And while that was very good and had a lot of stimulation and a lot of good discussions, it began to cause some problems in the church, which we still see today. And then the question really is, can we approach those people on a plane of higher thought? And I challenge you today to think about that today. If you've got somebody that is really smart, quote unquote smart, they don't believe in God, how do you witness to them? Do you try to be smarter than they are? Do you try to prove the Bible is existing? Do you try to prove who God is? You simply cannot do that. And so what you have to What you have to come to is there's a point at which you have to go back to the basics. And they either come to a point in their life where they believe it or they don't. And you can be there to help them, but you can't drag them over the line. And you can't goad them in or pressure them into becoming a Christian. Not a real Christian. I mean, they may join, but become a real Christian. So this whole movement began to create other problems in the church. And you see a lot of heresies begin to come up in the church. And I'll just make this point. One man's heresy is another man's truth. Because Martin Luther was a heretic. But Martin Luther was right. Now, he was a heretic because he went against the orthodox faith of the day. But that doesn't mean he was wrong. And we had heretics come up. A heretic is sort of something that he's taken a different path out of the normal, away from the general flock of people that everything else believes. And so all of this began to happen at this time, and we see the rise of a couple of thoughts. One of them is a term we call Gnosticism, and I'll just tell you, if I can find my notes here, I think I'm on the right page. Gnosticism we saw dealt with in some of Paul's letters, and that's really a belief that matter is evil and spirit is good. And since the human body is matter, God could not have actually created, because God can't touch evil. So God created this other being a little further away from him, and another one a little further away from him, and another one a little further away from him. And somewhere along that set of emanations from God is Christ, because Christ was the creator and Christ was among us. But he wasn't really God, he was an emanation of God. And they thought they had, Gnostic means special knowledge, they thought they had the secret word of the Lord, and that's, they had the knowledge, nobody else did. And I would just tell you, they don't call themselves Gnostic, but there are people in the, what we loosely call the Christian faith today, that believe they have the secret word from the Lord. Right. Nobody else has it. And oh, by the way, we're going to be surprised when we get up there and they're the only ones there, because we're not going to be there, you know. And there's a whole lot of that that goes on today. And that's called the Gnostics. The other ones are called the Docetics. And the Docetics, Docetism means dualism, or means to see. And what they said was, well, we don't really believe that this was an emanation of God, but we believe that it was a figment of our imagination, that God really didn't come to earth and God really didn't get crucified. And oh, by the way, since nobody's around here that saw that, who can refute it? Who can say, I saw the Lord and shook his hand? Nobody can say that, because we're 200 years past the crucifixion. And so they had this whole idea of it really wasn't the Lord. And the way they finally bridged the gap is they said, okay, well, so Jesus had two natures. The nature as a human was what Mary gave birth to. The spiritual nature of Jesus came when the dove settled on him when he was baptized. And then when he went to the cross before he died, that spirit left when he said, God, why have you forsaken me? And then the man Jesus died on the cross. So the spirit never really died. The spirit came and went and never really got touched by all of this sin and stuff in the world. And so the church had a lot of these kind of thoughts. And I'll just tell you that whole idea of dualism is around today. I have this thing called comparative religions. And I want to read you something. It talks about Christianity. It says, in section C, says, the sacred and the profane. Christian thought is characterized by a certain duality that divides reality into the profane, to include nature and the human body, and the sacred, to include God, spirit, and soul. Well, some of that's okay. Then they say, historically, Christians demonstrated a certain antagonism towards the natural world as profane and therefore inferior matter. The tendency has often surfaced in historical Christianity as a negative attitude towards physical pleasure in the human body. And while we could look at the Puritans and say, they didn't want anybody having any fun, the reality was the Puritans had a view of what God ordained and what he didn't. And what the world thinks is fun, if it's not God ordained, they don't want anything to do with it. And so I think we even see in these kind of what's purported to be a scholarly deal, we see where they take the Christian faith and they put into the minds of people reading it that we don't like nature, that we think something's evil in nature, and most Christians, I would tell you, don't feel that way at all. I mean, we love nature; it's part of God's creation, and so, you know, I think we see some of this stuff, you know, in our world today. And I'm going to stop here because right now we're about to the end of the period where Decius was the emperor. It's about 300 AD. He's killing Christians left and right. Finally, he discovers that it's not making any difference, that the Christians are being, within the Roman Empire, they're being recognized for their faithfulness and for burying the dead and doing some other things. So he calls off the dog, so to speak, on his deathbed. And that's sort of the end of major persecution. And of course, when he dies, Constantine comes to power, and Constantine becomes a Christian, and we'll talk about that next week. And then the Roman Empire basically becomes the Christian Roman Empire. But along the way, when Constantine was going to take over, he had to kill another Caesar, and so he caught him in Rome and killed him and his army and threw him in the Tiber River. So you can kind of see, while he proclaimed himself to be next to God, he wasn't above killing somebody if they got in his way. So we begin to see the nature of what's going to happen to the church in about 312 AD. I just want to make a comment that I've got this stuff in here. These two books, Erdman's Handbook is the one is that one up there on top. That's an old book. It's an excellent book. It's not a historical narrative. What it is, if you want to look up Clement or Origen, there's a section on him and you can go read about it. It's like a compendium of information. This one is a narrative. It starts with the ages and goes all the way through and in a very good way lays it out. Doesn't take a denominational stance on it. It just kind of lays it out and the chips fall where they may. And so that's what's good about that. Any questions or comments? We're finished with part two. Okay, so next week we're going to do institutions formed, the age of the Christian Roman Empire. So if you've that's a pretty interesting age. Actually, these two are very interesting ages in the church because we see the Middle Ages and a lot of different things that happen. So if you've got any interest in that, read up on that before you come, and we'll have a good time.
Now, where were they meeting?
How were they meeting?
Where?
Well, they first of all, they used to meet in synagogues, and they got kicked out of the synagogues. So they started meeting in houses. They started meeting in buildings. If somebody was wealthy and gave them a building, they would meet in it. And so they had a church in Ephesus. In some of the big areas, they began to have churches. But they met anywhere they could meet. They met in house churches. They met in upper rooms. They met in halls. They met in homes. Wherever they could meet, they met.
Is this when the catacombs in Rome started?
The catacombs started in this time. Because once they became Christian, they had to have a place to bury all the Christian leaders, and so the Christians talked them into giving them the underground, and they buried them in the catacombs, which is good because we have a lot of history now that we probably wouldn't have had before.
Where were the bishops during this time? Where did they meet? Were they just above all of the meetings?
They met in various areas. They met in Nicaea, and next week I'll put a list of where the bishops all met and what they came up with. There's about six or seven meetings that had fundamental changes in the church, and I've got that. I just didn't put it on a chart, but I'll put it on a chart and I'll show it. But they met in Nicaea, they met in Ephesus, they met in Rome, they met in Alexandria, they met in the big cities, you know, where the big bishops were, so to speak.
What did they do the rest of the time? I mean, were they in a local church?
They were in a local church. And as the churches got big, they began to manage several churches. So the bishop would be sort of the area director, so to speak, mm-hmm. And an elder or a pastor would run the day-to-day activities in the church. And the bishops had the role for authority in the church and discipline. So if you got out of line, you went to see the bishop. And so the pastor could pastor and the bishop discipline. And so that's the way the early church sort of started. And that's why they invested forgiveness in the bishops, because they were the ones that dealt with all the discipline issues.
Is this where the Catholics, they think the priest can forgive their sins?
Not yet. That comes later. That comes later. It comes quite a bit later, actually. So all I would say to you is, whatever you see in the church today, understand that it has no relation to the early church. Everything we see in the church today is traditions of man that have built up over the years and become our way to express what we believe. But to say that the church has always been a certain way is really false, because as you go back and look at these early churches, they were uniform, but they were kind of low church, if you will. They were all about praising and singing and preaching the word and having people come forward, and they preached the resurrected Christ. Their messages were simple, but effective.
They did sing gospel music, though.
Southern gospel. Yeah.
All of the information we're teaching, did you gather that from these two books?
Primarily these two books, but I've got a couple of other books that I use. There's one that I have that's like a pictorial dictionary, and it talks about certain things and how churches were made and all that kind of stuff. So, mostly these two books. Probably 75% of it you can get right here.
Yeah. I hate to cut you off, but I need my laptop. I've got another meeting.
I'm done. Any other questions?
Right job.